Howdy. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona bringing you the Arizona Daily Star for Tuesday, August 26th, 2025. Read for you by David Grant. On the front page, a ruling might improve effort to find unclaimed property owners. Howard Fisher of Capital Media Services. Arizonans could soon get better notice if the state is holding on to their share of nearly $2.8 billion in unclaimed property that belongs to them. In a unanimous decision Monday, a three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals gave the go-ahead for two individuals to sue the state agency for failing to provide them with sufficient notice that it was holding on to money or other property that it listed as unclaimed or abandoned. The ruling now allows them to sue the agency for violating their due process rights. Appellate Judge Danielle Forrest, writing for the court, rejected claims by the attorneys for the state that it could not be sued. When someone, even the government, possesses property lawfully owned by another without the owner's consent, an invasion of the owner's legally protected interest has occurred, she wrote. Monday's ruling does not invalidate the law known as the Unclaimed Property Act, but simply sends the case back to the trial judge who had thrown it out. But if the challengers win, it could overrule the law, which says the Department of Revenue need do no more than publish a list of names online twice a year of those whose properties it has. Instead, it could require state workers to do more than just try to find the owners, rather than have the state simply hold the property, collect interest on the cash, and after 35 years be able to claim it for themselves. The issue isn't news. As far back as 1996, Capital Media Services wrote that the Department of Revenue was publishing names and addresses on a list and at that time printed in newspapers of what it said was unclaimed property. But a reporter managed to find some of these individuals simply by using the phone book. That was before people could be easily found online. A spokeswoman said Monday that the agency is reviewing the opinion and considering the next steps. What is at issue here is a laundry list of what the state considers to be unclaimed property. It ranges from outstanding payroll checks, matured certificates of deposit, and unclaimed securities to unreturned security deposits and amounts due under the terms of insurance policies. According to the agency, there are a host of reasons that property becomes unclaimed. For example, a business may lose track of its owners due to a change of address. Property may become abandoned due to the death of an owner and the family is unaware of the assets. Sometimes a customer will overpay on an account and send a check with no indication as to which account the payment applies. These credit balances are often just left on the books of companies. And then there are uncashed checks lost in the mail or put in a drawer or forgotten. Under Arizona law, the owner of the property is required to send a written notice to the apparent owner. After waiting at least 120 days, the property is transferred to the Department of Revenue. Judge Forrest acknowledged that the law requires a state to operate a website listing the unclaimed property in its possession. But Arizona's statute does not maintain that the state provide actual notice to the apparent owner that it has possession of their property, she wrote. Forrest also noted that the unclaimed funds are deposited into the state's general fund, though there is a requirement to set aside at least $100,000 to pay claims. Any of the claims have to be filed within 35 years. The department is listing the value of its unclaimed property at $2.79 billion. The agency reports it returned more than $88 million to owners each of the last 2 years. In filing suit in 2022, Jessica Garza and Kevin Terrell do not deny that their names were among those published online by the Department of Revenue. The site did not list exactly what kind of property the state was holding. Their attorneys said, though, that they received no notice from anyone, not the original holder of the property nor the state, and that their property was being held, though their identities were known to the holders at the time plaintiff's property was taken. They argue that simply doing online publication falls short of the basic legal requirements before a property can be taken. They contend that the agency has reason for not doing more, being able to seize property, private property from citizens, use it to generate income for the state, and then convert it for the use as revenue for the state. Forrest said that the fact that the state was simply holding the property meant that the plaintiffs had no basis to claim it. It had been illegally taken from them. But she said it still leaves the question as to whether the system used by the state denies them their 14th Amendment constitutional right of due process. The Unclaimed Property Act itself recognizes that owners have a property interest in presumptively abandoned property, and it allows owners to file a claim to that property for 35 years after the department takes possession, the judge wrote. Defendants themselves recognize the plaintiffs allegedly own property in possession of the department. Attorneys for the state argue that the plaintiffs have not been deprived of their property because they can claim it within 35 years. That is incorrect, Forrest wrote. The Supreme Court has held that even a temporary, non-final deprivation of property is nonetheless a deprivation in terms of the 14th Amendment. And there's something else that the appellate judges said makes the Arizona law suspect. They point out, in some circumstances, property can be considered unclaimed or abandoned in as little as a year. That includes wages, property from a dissolved corporation, and even certain annuities. Individuals may go about their daily lives without any indication that their property has changed possession, Forrest wrote. Other items have to be held longer before they can be considered unclaimed. For example, it takes 3 years before a money order is presumed unclaimed. Ditto, certificates of deposit and credits owed to a customer as a result of a retail business transaction. That same 3-year limit applies to contents of safe deposit boxes, though the law does allow the agency to sell off the property with the owner if identified paid the net profits proceeds. The longest time before abandonment is 15 years for traveler's checks. After that, the judge said, compares with Indiana law, which requires property be held for 20 years before considered abandoned. All that, Forrest said, goes to the central issue of whether people are deprived of notice. If notice is required, it must be reasonably calculated under all circumstances to apprise interested parties of their pendency of the action and afford them an opportunity to present their objections, she said. In this case, she said, all that Arizona law requires is that the holder of the property provide 120 days to the reported owner before transferring it to the state. And after that, the department receives unclaimed property. The Unclaimed Property Act requires only that the department publish a notice at least semi-annually, directing the public to the department's website regarding abandoned property, Forrest wrote. And in this case, she said the two individuals are entitled to argue in court that they did not receive adequate notice. The agency sends out thousands of notices each year to the addresses that it does have, said Rebecca Wilder, an agency spokeswoman. But Wilder said the property becomes unclaimed because the company that holds the funds has an outdated address or the wrong forwarding address for the customer. This means that the department is challenged with locating owners through the reported address information that we receive, she said. Wilder said, though, that her agency does promote the online program both through public service announcements and targeted ads in print and, more recently, radio. She said that it also works with other state agencies here and elsewhere to track owners. Yet there still appears to be circumstances where it shouldn't take much to find the rightful owners. Among the property owners currently listed on the website as having unclaimed property is the Katie Hobbs for Secretaries of State Election Committee with East McDowell Road address, the same one she is now using for her gubernatorial reelection campaign. It does not say how much the campaign's funds that the state is holding. Howard Fisher is a veteran journalist who has been reporting since 1970, covering state politics and the legislature since 1982. You can follow them on X, Blue Sky, and Threads at azcapmedia, or email at azcapmedia@gmail.com. And on the right side column, we have ICE offers look inside training facility. This is from Rebecca Santana of the Associated Press. Brunswick, Georgia. At an obstacle course in the humid Georgia heat, an instructor shows recruits how to pull a wounded partner out of danger. In a classroom with desks cluttered with thick legal books about immigration law, recruits learn how the Fourth Amendment governs their work. And on a firing range littered with shell casings, new recruits for Immigration and Customs Enforcement practice shooting their handguns. "Instructors, give me a thumbs up when the students are ready to go," a voice over the loudspeaker said before a group of about 20 ICE recruits practice drawing and firing their weapons. The Federal Law Enforcement Training Facility Center in Brunswick, Georgia, is the epicenter of training for almost all federal law enforcement officers, including the Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers, who are at the center of President Donald Trump's mass deportation efforts. Now, with lots of money approved by Congress this summer that's starting to flow into ICE, the agency is in the midst of a huge hiring effort as it aims to get thousands of new deportation officers into the field in the coming months. On Thursday, the Associated Press and other news organizations got a rare look at the basic immigration law enforcement training program that new ICE recruits, specifically those in the Enforcement and Removal Operations Unit, responsible for finding, arresting, and removing people from the country, go through and what they learn. ICE is getting $76.5 billion in new money from the Congress to help it meet Trump's mass deportation goal. That's nearly 10 times the agency's current annual budget. Nearly $30 billion of that money is for new staff. They're hiring across the agency, including investigators and lawyers, but the numbers they're hiring in those areas pale in comparison to how many new deportation officers are coming on board. Todd Lyons, the acting director of ICE, was at the training demonstration Thursday. He said that the agency currently has about 6,500 deportation officers and is aiming to hire 10,000 more by the end of the year. With that hiring surge has come some concerns about that vetting or training of the new recruits will be shortchanged. The Border Patrol went through a similar hiring surge in the early 2000s when hiring and training standards were changed. Arrests for employee misconduct rose. Lyons pushed back on concerns that ICE may cut corners when it comes to training, although he said they have made changes designed to streamline the process. "I wasn't going to water down training," said Lyons. Caleb Vitello, the assistant director of ICE in charge of training, says that new recruits will go through about 8 weeks of training at the Georgia facility, as well as training before and after they come here. One key change, Vitello noticed, ICE cut out 5 weeks of Spanish language training because it said new recruits were only getting to the point of being moderately competent in Spanish. He said language translation technology can help fill the void in the field. During the 6 days a week training, new recruits live on the grounds of the sprawling facility a little less than an hour's drive from the Florida state line, north of the Florida state line. Hundreds have gone through the training here in recent months. New recruits train on firearms on a large indoor shooting range that looks as big as a football field. Dean Wilson, who oversees the firearms training, compared some of the operations that ICE agents face to a haunted house where they don't know what might be coming at them. "We do our very best to make sure that even though they're in that environment, that they have the wherewithal to make the proper decision," said Wilson. "Nobody wants to be the one to make a bad shot, and nobody wants to be the one who doesn't make it home." The curriculum also includes de-escalation techniques designed to prevent the use of force in the first place, Lyons said. "In any type of law enforcement situation," he said, "you'd rather de-escalate with words before you have to use any force. Not all the training is in the field." ICE agents like to point out that when it comes to complexity, immigration law is second only to the tax code. At the training academy, they get about 12 hours of classroom instruction on things like the Fourth Amendment, the part of the Constitution that protects against unreasonable searches and seizures, and the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1952, which has evolved over the decades and governs all facets of immigration. These legal lessons also are interspersed throughout the rest of the training. On the desks in one classroom are training manuals in immigration law handbooks, roughly 2 to 3 inches thick. Recruits learn how to determine whether somebody is removable from the country, under what circumstances they can go into someone's house to search, and when they have to leave. Emmett Till Records released. This is from Graham Lee Brewer, the Associated Press. Just days ahead of the 70th anniversary of his killing, the federal government made public thousands of pages of records Friday on the lynching of Emmett Till. The records in the National Archives, released by the Civil Rights Cold Case Records Review Board, detail how the Justice Department, the FBI, and the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights responded to the 1955 killing of 14-year-old Till. The records were released in accordance with the Civil Rights Cold Case Records Collection Act of 2018. Our thoughts are with the Till family, the National Archives and Records Administration said in a news release. The Chicago teenager was falsely accused of whistling at a white woman in a grocery store in rural Mississippi. 4 days later, Till was abducted from a great uncle's home in the pre-dawn hours by Roy Bryant and John William J.W. Millam. The white men tortured and killed Till in a barn in a neighboring county. His body was later found in the Tallahatchie River. Bryant and Millam were charged with murder in Till's death, but were acquitted by an all-white male jury. Bryant and Millam later confessed to a reporter that they had kidnapped and killed Till. His killing galvanized the civil rights movement after Till's mother, Mamie Till Mobley, insisted on an open casket so the country could see the brutality. In 2022, Democratic President Joe Biden signed a bill named for Till that made lynching a federal hate crime. In 2023, Biden signed a proclamation establishing a national monument honoring Till and his mother. Turning to national and world news, Epstein case, panel subpoenas the state. Committee wants docs, including contacts list and birthday book. This is from Stephen Groves of the Associated Press, Washington. The House Oversight Committee subpoenaed the estate of the late Jeffrey Epstein on Monday as congressional lawmakers try to determine who was connected to the disgraced financier and whether prosecutors mishandled his case. The committee's subpoena is the latest effort by both Republicans and Democrats to respond to public clamor for more disclosure in the investigation into Epstein, who was found dead in his New York jail cell in 2019. Lawmakers are trying to guide an investigation into who among Epstein's high-powered social circle may have been aware of his sexual abuse of teenage girls, delving into a criminal case that spurred conspiracy theories and roiled top officials in President Donald Trump's administration. The subpoena, signed by Representative James Comer, the Republican chair of the Oversight Committee, demands Epstein's estate provide Congress with documents, including a book that was compiled with notes from friends for his 50th birthday, his last will and testament, agreements he signed with prosecutors, his contact books, and his financial transactions and holdings. Comer wrote to the executors of Epstein's estate that the committee is reviewing the possible mismanagement of the federal government's investigation into Mr. Jeffrey Epstein and Ms. Ghislaine Maxwell, the circumstances and subsequent investigation of Mr. Epstein's death, the operation of sex trafficking rings, and ways for the federal government to effectively combat them, and potential violations of ethic rules related to elected officials. The Justice Department, trying to distance Trump from Epstein, began handing over some documentation of the federal investigation into Epstein to lawmakers last week. It also released the transcripts of interviews conducted this month with Ghislaine Maxwell, his former girlfriend. But Democrats on the committee are not satisfied with those efforts, saying that the 33,000 pages of documents they received are mostly already public. DOJ's limited disclosure raises more questions than answers and makes clear that the White House is not interested in justice for the victims or the truth. Representative Robert Garcia, the top Democrat on the House Oversight Committee, said in a statement, "A bipartisan group of House members is attempting to maneuver around Republican leadership to hold a vote to pass legislation meant to require the Justice Department to release a full accounting of the sex trafficking investigation into Epstein." And at 20 minutes past the hour, let's go to Washington. Parents on edge over armed patrols. Schools reopen in D.C. as President Trump's federal takeover continues. This is from Mark Sherman of the Associated Press. Washington. Public schools reopened Monday in the nation's capital with parents on edge over the presence of thousands of National Guard troops, some armed and some federal law enforcement officers. Even as President Donald Trump again touted a drop in crime that he attributed to his extraordinary effort to take over policing in Washington, D.C., the district's mayor lamented the effect of Trump's action on children. "Parents are anxious," Mayor Muriel Bowser said at a news conference, noting that some might keep the children out of school because of immigration concerns. "We know that our schools are the safest places for our students, and we invest a lot in their learning. And if they're not at school, they can't take advantage of that learning. So I would just call on everyone to leave our kids alone, let them get a great start on their school day and school year and the rest of their lives," she said. This week, beginning with some patrolling National Guard units now carrying firearms, the change stemmed from a directive issued late last week by Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth. About a half dozen National Guard troops walked the district's main convention center early Monday morning with pistols on their hips, according to an Associated Press reporter. But an AP photographer said none of the roughly 30 troops he saw on the National Mall were carrying a weapon. A statement from the Joint Task Force that took over policing in the nation's capital said that units began carrying their service weapons on Sunday. Bowser reiterated her opposition to the National Guard's presence. "I don't believe that troops should be policing American cities," she said. Trump is considering expanding the deployments to other Democratic-led cities, including Baltimore, Chicago, and New York. In June, about 4,000 National Guard troops and 700 Marines were sent to Los Angeles to deal with protests over the administration's immigration crackdown. California's Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom and other elected officials objected. FEMA staff called out cuts to disaster assistance. Current and former employees say U.S. is at risk for a Katrina repeat. This is from the Associated Press. More than 180 current and former employees of the Federal Emergency Management Agency published a letter Monday warning that debilitating cuts to the agency charged with handling federal disaster response risks a catastrophe like the one seen after Hurricane Katrina. "Our shared commitment to our country, our oaths of office, and our mission of helping people before, during, and after disasters compel us to warn Congress and the American people of the cascading effects of decisions made by the current administration," the letter states. The statement is noteworthy as a harsh reproach towards critics by the Trump administration caused many in the federal government to hesitate before publicly criticizing the White House. The letter coincides with the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, when more than 1,800 people died and profound failures in the federal response prompted Congress to pass the Post-Katrina Emergency Management Reform Act of 2006. The letter warns that poor management and eroded capacity at FEMA could undo the progress made to improve the agency through that law. And in the News Digest, Trump bans flag burning despite a 1989 court ruling, Washington. President Donald Trump signed an executive order Monday requiring the Justice Department to investigate and prosecute people for burning the American flag, an activity that the U.S. Supreme Court ruled is legitimate political expression protected by the U.S. Constitution. The order that the Republican president signed in the Oval Office acknowledged the court's 5-4 ruling in a case from Texas in 1989, but it said there's still room to prosecute flag burning if it is likely to incite imminent lawless action or amounts to fighting words. In that case, the judges ruled 5-4 that the First Amendment protects flag burning as a legitimate political expression. The late Justice Antonin Scalia was in the majority. South Korean leader earns favor with Trump. Washington. President Donald Trump took to social media before meeting with South Korean President Lee Jae-myung on Monday to threaten not to do business with Seoul because of a purge or revolution that he claimed was taking place in the country. But any prospect of a hostile Oval Office meeting evaporated after Lee heaped praise onto the U.S. president, lauding the new Oval Office decor, beseeching Trump to continue to help with Korean peace efforts, and even suggesting a Trump Tower in North Korea. After running down the agenda for the summit, Trump added, "It's a great honor to be with you, and congratulations on your election. That was a big one, and we're with you 100%. Briefly, antitrust suit. Elon Musk targeted Apple and OpenAI in an antitrust lawsuit Monday, alleging that the iPhone maker and the ChatGPT maker are teaming up to thwart competition in artificial intelligence. The case was filed in a Texas federal court. Ukraine war. U.S. President Donald Trump's special envoy, Keith Kellogg, said Monday in Kiev that officials are working very, very hard to end the 3-year war between Russia and Ukraine, as a lack of progress fuels doubts about whether a peace settlement could be on the horizon. Yemen. The death toll from Israel's latest airstrike on Yemen's rebel-held capital rose to 10, health officials said Monday. Multiple strikes rocked Sana'a on Sunday, days after Iranian-backed Houthis fired a rocket missile towards Israel. New York. The deaths of 21 dogs in an upstate New York boarding facility are under investigation, authorities said Monday. The Washington County Sheriff's Office said the dogs were found Sunday at Anastasia's Acres dog boarding facility in Argyle. It was not immediately clear what caused the deaths, and officials said the owners were cooperating with the investigation. Cartel kingpin. Former Mexican cartel kingpin Ismael El Mayo Zambada pleaded guilty to a U.S. drug trafficking charges, saying he was sorry for helping flood the U.S. with cocaine, heroin, and other illicit substances, and for fueling deadly violence in Mexico. Western wildfires. 10 structures, including 4 homes, were destroyed by a wildfire sweeping through central Oregon, where thousands of residents remain under evacuation orders on Monday, while a blaze in Northern California wine country spared some of the state's most famous vineyards. This is from the Associated Press. And in Tucson Giving, if you go, what? The 25th annual Bags for Kids Sewathon to support Aviva Children's Services. When? 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Saturday, September 13th. Where? Christ Presbyterian Church, 6565 East Broadway. Cost? Free volunteers are needed to sew cord and duffel bags for children in the foster care system. Sewers are needed to bring a sewing machine or serger, neutral thread, scissors, and other items such as seam rippers, extra needles, and cushions for chairs. Volunteers are also needed to assist with setup, transporting sewing machines at the event, and other activities. Festivities include raffles and giveaways for participants, and a light breakfast, snack, and lunch during the day-long event. You can go to http://tucne.ws/1ssw to volunteer. Volunteers are welcome to donate books, puzzles, or board games that will be used for Aviva Children's Services Holiday Toy Drive. If you'd like to provide Aviva with monetary support, you can make an online donation at www.avivatucson.org. And in business, Dr. Pepper buys Pete's Coffee for $18 billion. Associated Press, New York. Keurig Dr. Pepper will buy the owner of Pete's Coffee in an $18 billion deal, then break itself into two, with one company selling coffee and the other selling cold beverages like Snapple, Dr. Pepper, 7-Up, and energy drinks. The agreement announced Monday will essentially unwind a 2018 merger of Keurig and Dr. Pepper, and it arrives at a time when consumers are pulling back and the trade wars under President Donald Trump threaten to send coffee prices soaring. Trump imposed a 50% tariff this summer on most imports from Brazil, the world's leading coffee producer, for its investigation of its former president, Jair Bolsonaro, a Trump ally. Yet Keurig Dr. Pepper sees both coffee and cold beverages as areas of growth that would be better navigated by independently operating companies. CEO Tim Cofer called it a transformational moment for the sector. By creating two sharply focused beverage companies with an attractive and tailored growth propositions and capital allocation strategies, we are poised to generate significant shareholder value in both the near and the long term, Cofer wrote in a statement. But large chains like Starbucks are suffering. Same-store sales, a key barometer of a retailer's health, have fallen for six straight quarters at the Seattle coffee giant, and its shares have tumbled 23% since March. Keurig Dr. Pepper is offsetting some declines with higher prices. In its last quarter, the company reported a 0.2% decline in coffee sales. For Keurig Dr. Pepper, the soon-to-be separated coffee business will have about $16 billion in combined sales, and the beverage business about $11 billion, the company said. The company is expected to save about $400 million over 3 years because of the merger. The company that Keurig Dr. Pepper is buying, Pete's parent, JDE Pete, that's P-E-E-T, based in Amsterdam, also owns the branches Loor, Jacobs, Dewey, Egberts, Kenco, Pilau, Old Town, Super, and Makana. Once the two companies are separated, Cofer will become CEO of the cold beverage business, which will be based in Frisco, Texas. Keurig Dr. Pepper's chief financial officer, Sunashu Priyadarshi, will lead the coffee business and will be located in Burlington, Massachusetts. Its international headquarters is in Amsterdam. Shares of Keurig Dr. Pepper slumped 9% before the opening bell on Monday. In Tucson and regional news, how Arizona could fare in a mid-decade census is from Ronald J. Hansen of the Arizona Republic. Arizona could gain an extra congressional seat if President Donald Trump succeeds in implementing a mid-decade census, including excluding illegal immigrants, but the cost, logistics, and legality of the whole idea cast doubt that it will happen. The presidential proposal calls for an unprecedented effort to count only some U.S. residents, upending the practice of counting everyone and inviting an unsettling error rate that could yield results that might not deliver as many Republican seats as Trump presumably wants, experts say. The results of a census that seeks to count immigrants but not illegal ones is untested, and recent history suggests Arizona, for one, could be blindsided by actual participation levels. Even so, an Arizona Republic analysis of various demographic scenarios suggests that if the state would begin any undertaking, it's likely to pick up a 10th seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. I have instructed our Department of Commerce to immediately begin work on a new and highly accurate census based on modern-day facts and figures, and most importantly, using the results and information gained from the presidential election of 2024. Trump wrote in a social media post on August 7th, "People who are in our country illegally will not be counted in the census," all caps. Apart from the mid-decade census proposal, the ongoing mid-decade redistricting playing out in Texas, California, and perhaps other states is already giving the GOP a new edge on holding on to control of the House. The president, I think, is going through a political agenda with a lot of wishful thinking, said Jeffrey Weiss, a professor at the New York Law School and an expert on redistricting and census law. It's an expensive idea. While mid-decade redistricting is permitted, though rare, an off-cycle census excluding people seems legally dubious to experts on the subject. Courts have affirmed counting everyone since the 14th Amendment that addressed citizenship and equal protection rights after the Civil War. Sam Wang is a neuroscience professor at Princeton University who helped create the Princeton Gerrymandering Project that researches the outcome of politically driven maps. He called Trump's proposal a crackpot idea. First off, it's unconstitutional to leave out people who are not citizens. Secondly, it's logistically impossible. The Census Bureau takes a whole decade to get ready for a decennial census. It would be a bridge to the 19th century, Wang said. Time and money pose other hurdles. The 2020 census cost $14 billion and took a decade to plan, Weiss said. And others noted the time it takes to design and execute a census, followed by apportionment, the process of relocating House seats based on new population numbers, and concluding with a process of redrawing maps in all 50 states. Kimball Brace was a member of the Census Bureau's 2020 advisory panel and is president of the Virginia-based Election Data Services, which has provided technical assistance to Democrats for redistricting. He said states need granular data to redraw their maps that not only a complete census, but not an estimate can provide. If he's going to do something with estimates for the number of people in each county and try to claim that the way to look at this is, well, you've got 3,000 counties and 435 districts, they're not going to square up, Brace said. The way of generating estimates are a real suspect, and in a short period of time, you're not going to be doing a good job. Trump didn't say whether the special census would be done ahead of the 2026 midterm elections or the 2028 presidential election, which will be just 2 years before the normally timed decennial census. Congress approved the idea of a mid-decade census in the 1970s, said Margot Anderson, a history professor emeritus with the University of Wisconsin, who has researched the census. At the time, Congress recognized the need for more regular data than a decennial census could provide, but the idea, which specifically rules out using data for apportionment and required the count to be taken in years ending in five, never got funded. A mid-decade census idea eventually gave way to the Census Bureau's American Community Survey, which now provides extensive new demographic estimates every year. Arizona stands apart from other states that could draw benefits from another population update in one key respect. It draws its political boundaries using an independent redistricting commission. In most cases, the state's gaining steps use maps already drawn by Republicans. The Republic considered Arizona's relative standing using the U.S. Census Bureau's 2023 state population estimates and subtracted the 2023 estimated illegal immigration population as calculated by the nonpartisan Pew Research Center. The Republic also analyzed results using only U.S.-born citizens and other combining native-born citizens with naturalized citizens. These scenarios illustrate how the results of any census could alter the results for congressional representation depending on demographic participation levels. Red states would likely benefit. Trump's preferred census is inherently speculative, in part because of the illegal immigration population is never precisely known or evenly distributed. Also, the Trump administration crackdown on illegal immigrants could discourage participation from legal immigrants or lead respondents to lie in their answers on citizenship. Thomas Heffler, now dead, Republican, described by the New York Times as the Michelangelo of gerrymandering, urged the inclusion of citizenship question in the census because he thought it would benefit the GOP. He urged the Trump administration to pursue it before his death in 2018. Arizona has experienced census fallout in the past two decennial counts. In 2010, the formal census count was tied to April 1st, within days of the passage of the polarizing Senate Bill 1070, immigration enforcing law Arizona passed. That law helped drive off countless immigrants, both legal and illegal. It also came as the state was shaking off from the housing bust. Arizona's final population count was lower than expected and varied from the Census Bureau's estimate by the widest margin in the country. That impacted the expected allotment of federal grants for a decade. 10 years later, amid a nationwide quarantine for the COVID-19 pandemic, Arizona narrowly missed out on getting a 10th congressional seat from the 2020 census. Arizona did little to encourage participation. California spent millions trying to boost it. Arizona's eventual 64% response rate to the census was below the 67% national average, which is still not great. And California's response rate was nearly 70%. In the end, both states missed their objectives in counts made far more difficult because of COVID. And now it's about 20 minutes before the hour. Aluminum plant raises concerns. This is from Sarah Lapidus of the Arizona Republic. Frustration and anger boiled over at a public hearing in Benson as residents begged Arizona's environmental agency to deny an air quality permit application from Aluminum Dynamics Incorporated, saying that they fear the out-of-state company will pollute the town's air and groundwater. The Indiana-based company, which unsuccessfully tried to open an industrial plant in Gila Bend in 2024, has applied for a clean air permit to move forward with its sprawling $190 million aluminum recycling plant in Benson. It would be located near the intersection of State Route 80 and East 7th Street. With a nursing home across the street from the proposed plant and Benson schools less than a mile away, residents are worried about how pollutants from the facility would impact public health. They also wondered how the plant would impact the longevity of the 5,000-person city. We live in this area because it's clean and has beautiful sights, and we're close to recreational facilities. We like the river, we like the monsoons, we like the wildlife, said resident Nancy Casarella at a hearing with the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality on August 21st. We don't want dirty air, we don't want stinky air, we don't want dirty water, we don't want this plant. Please, please try to help us. City Manager Greg Volker, who also serves as police chief, said Aluminum Dynamics, by right, is allowed to build at the site in Benson. The city's stance is simple. The land had been zoned for heavy industry since 1962, reaffirmed in 1991 and 1994, and recently approved by the General Development Plan. By right, the business can build in Benson, and we support upholding the law. Due to this not being an issue that we can go to the city council, it has not, he said in an email to the Arizona Republic. The plant's water meter would allow it to flush roughly 500,000 gallons of water per day if running a full flush, said Volker. If they're running a full flush, it would be like 40 houses running on full flush. But nobody runs full time, he said. Volker added that officials won't know how much water the plant needs until it's fully operational. Gila Bend Council rejected the plant. Aluminum Dynamics approached the city of Benson about its project in November 2024, just 2 months after it sued Gila Bend for denying a zoning change for its facility to recycle and process aluminum cans. The company said in court records that it bought a property in Gila Bend in June 2023 after a lengthy due diligence process. It sought to change the zoning of the parcel after low-density residential to heavy industrial to build its plants, according to court records. Minutes from a July 9, 2024, Gila Bend Town Council meeting reported numerous concerns about the project from a citizens' review session. These concerns revolved around issues with odor, pollution, and noise. The city's Planning and Zoning Commission recommended 33 stipulations for approval related to air quality testing, odor control, emergency response plans, noise control, and more. One council member said that the aluminum recycling plant did not belong so close to the community and its residents, and felt that council members were strong-armed into making the decision. Some council members said they wished the council could have begun discussing this project a year earlier. The council voted 4-3 to approve the zoning change, which failed to clear the required two-thirds threshold. What pollutants will be emitted? The Benson facility plans to produce aluminum ingots, large metal blocks from recycled aluminum scrap, to be sent to the company's mill being constructed in Mississippi. The Benson plant would conduct a large range of activities, including scrap processing, melting, and casting of aluminum and auxiliary systems. A state Clean Air Act permit is required because the amount of air pollutants the facility could potentially emit exceeds the permitting thresholds. This will result in the plant being subject to various state and federal air quality regulations, according to the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality. The plant will operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and could release a variety of hazardous pollutants totaling 100.7 tons per year before taking into account of control measures, according to a support document in the application. The permit requires baghouse filters to be used to limit emissions. A baghouse utilizes fabric filtration to remove particles from contaminated gas streams by depositing the particles onto the fabric material, according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Pollutants include hydrochloric acid, nitrogen oxides, volatile organic compounds, sulfur dioxide, carbon monoxide. Two cooling towers will emit a mixture of solid particles and liquid droplets found in the air. Additionally, the plant would have the potential to emit 86,398 tons per year of greenhouse gas. The agency's draft permit lists emission limits and standards for various hazardous air pollutants and outlines how the company is required to monitor and report emissions. Benson residents voiced concerns to the state agency and that there weren't enough stringent testings and monitoring requirements and no third-party monitoring. One organizer of the grassroots movement opposing this project is Kristen Bidegain, a part-time nurse and mother of two children. This entire situation exists because our local government allowed this company to move in at a location that it should have never been considered. They failed to research what this type of operation is doing and ignored the company's track record of non-compliance with pollution regulations, Bidegain said at the meeting. And it should not be the responsibility of the public to double-check the ADEQ's work or prove whether this permit is appropriate when it's our health and our safety, our peace of mind, and our children's future that are at stake. And now for something completely different, let's go to Lifestyles, the Royal Stars from Georgia Nichols. Happy birthday for Tuesday, August 26th, 2025. You are innovative and curious. You're also imaginative, disciplined, and tenacious. This year is about learning and teaching. Time to renew your spiritual or religious beliefs. For Aries, March 21st through April 19th, this is a tricky day because several influences might affect your relationships. New and exciting friends who are freedom-loving and stimulating might come into your world tonight. Cooperate. Taurus, April 20th through May 20th. Stock the fridge, because you might unexpectedly entertain at home tonight. Friends or a family member might surprise you. Tonight, get organized. Gemini, May 21st through June 20th. Today, new faces and new places might be a surprise. Conversations with others could be stimulating, even inspiring. Tonight, socialize. Cancer, June 21st through July 22nd. Something unexpected might impact your finances today. It could be a brilliant idea that impresses others, especially bosses. Tonight, cocoon at home. Leo, July 23rd through August 22nd. Today, fair Venus is in your sign dancing with unpredictable Uranus, urging you to break away from routine. You want the freedom to do what you want. Tonight, conversations. Virgo, August 23rd through September 22nd. You are the sign of service, which means you like to be useful, and in particular, you like to benefit others if possible. Tonight, check your belongings. Libra, September 23rd through October 22nd. By nature, you are a people pleaser. Today, you might have an unexpected opportunity to help someone. This person could be a friend or a member of a group. Tonight, you're in charge. You make a favorable impression on others today, especially authority figures. Tonight, privacy. Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st. Be on the lookout for unexpected opportunities to travel. Likewise, surprising events could impact legal, medical, or educational matters. Tonight, be friendly. Capricorn, December 22nd through January 19th. Today, you might benefit unexpectedly from a windfall or a favor from someone in terms of money, gifts, or practical gestures. Tonight, show respect. Aquarius, January 20th through February 18th. Partnerships and close friendships are exciting today. Unexpected events are unfolding that are not only stimulating, they're inspiring as well. Tonight, explore. Pisces, February 19th through March 20th. Something unexpected at work will please you today. Whatever transpires might make you feel generous to someone. This is why you might try to help others. Tonight, check your finances. And turning to sports, SCORE Act could create college sports inequities, Senator says. This is from Eddie Pels of the Associated Press. A Democratic U.S. lawmaker sent a letter to leaders at the more than 350 Division I schools across the country Monday, warning of a two-tier college sports systems with haves and have-nots if a proposed bill to regulate the industry passes without changes. In the letter, Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington, the ranking member of a committee that oversees college sports, said that the SCORE Act could incentivize a Power 2 conference system that will create inequities for other conferences and leave small to mid-sized schools behind. The Power Two she references is the Big Ten and the Southeastern Conference, which share the decision-making power for the future of college football playoffs. With its $7.8 billion media rights deal, it's the single largest financial driver of all college athletics. The House is expected to vote on the SCORE Act next month. It would provide the NCAA a limited antitrust exemption, override state laws designed to regulate name, image, and likeness payments, and prevent athletes from becoming employees at their universities. Cantwell argued against those parts of the bill, while also focusing on language that she said would lead to the removal of the 22% cap on revenue sharing implemented by the recently approved lawsuit settlement. This school year, the 22% cap equals $20.5 million that can be paid out to players, but some schools will be able to exceed that using third-party deals that have to be approved by the newly created College Sports Commission. If passed, the SCORE Act will entrench the current arms race to recruit and retain athletes and leave small and mid-sized schools unable to compete for championships and postseason games, along with the inability to earn the increased revenue that comes with those opportunities, Cantwell wrote. Cantwell noted media reports that Pac-12 schools were previously part of what was known as the Power Five will receive 63% less in revenue from TV rights than before the latest round of conference realignment. She also pointed out the new arrangement in the Atlantic Coast Conference that calls for 60% of the league's distribution to be based on viewership ratings are largely driven by football and men's hoops, a provision designed to appeal to its highest profile teams. Ultimately, the broad antitrust exemption of the SCORE Act would widen existing inequalities among schools and conferences, creating long-term instability of schools of all sizes, Cantwell said. The SCORE Act would need the backing of at least 7 Democrats in the Senate to pass as a standalone bill, although there's a chance it could be attached to a larger piece of must-pass legislation, which would diminish their chances of making substantive amendments. And lastly, in Arizona football, the University of Arizona pursues stadium naming deal. This is from Michael Lev, the Arizona Daily Star. As department staff and media awaited the arrival of a games day concession samples, Arizona Athletic Director Desiree Reed Francois delivered a State of the Wildcats address Monday at Arizona Stadium. Among the topics she discussed was the possibility of naming rights for Arizona Stadium, a potentially lucrative revenue source that Reed Francois is determined to tap into. Brian Rooney, the general manager of the recently formed Arizona Sports Enterprise, was unable to attend Monday's press conference because he was participating in a pitch meeting with one potential stadium sponsor, Casino del Sol. There are also a handful of other possible candidates. Any agreement, ideally, would bring in 7 figures annually. ASU's deal with Mountain America Credit Union is worth more than $50 million over 15 years. We're making a lot of progress, Reed Francois said. I'd love to tell you, hey, we could have it done in 2 weeks. I don't know. It could be 2 weeks. It could be 18 months. There's a lot of conversations, and there's a lot of analytics that have gone into it. It's usually about an 18 to 24 month process. We are active. And thank you for listening. This has been Sun Sounds of Arizona, bringing you the Arizona Daily Star for August 26th, 2025, and read for you by David Grant. Till next time, have a great week and enjoy the monsoon.